Case number 07-1026. National Mining Association petitioner versus Mine Safety Administration, et al. Commissioner Wu for the petitioner, Mr. Feingold for the respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Counsel, my name is Dan Wolf. I am for Petitioner National Mining Association. With me at council table is Thomas C. Means. I would like to reserve 6 minutes for rebuttal. NMA petitions this court to remand the additional SCSR provisions of the Emergency Mine Evacuation Rule promulgated by the Secretary of Labor in December 2006 for three reasons. First, it conflicts with the Miner Act, the Mine Improvement and New Emergency Response Act, enacted by Congress in June 2006. The rule is therefore invalid.
How does it conflict with that statute in any way that makes your claim a good claim?
In this way, Judge Sentel, as the Secretary herself notes at page 11 of her brief, the Miner Act permits, at least at the proposal stage in an emergency.
Forget at proposal stage. You go to the Act and tell me how the promulgation, the rule as promulgated by the agency, conflicts with that statute. It's not a statute till it's enacted.
That's correct.
Congress enacted a set of language, and I have read your brief, believe me, I've read your brief, and I am at a loss to see how anything in the language of that act is contravened by anything in the regulatory language.
Well, Your Honor.
It may be that if the miners had come in here saying that the provision for allowing the alternate of the cross passage location for the redundant systems, if they had come in and said that was in conflict with the statute, they might have a good argument.
Well, Your Honor,
I can't for the life of me see how you have an argument that this contravenes the Act in any way helpful to you.
This is the way it should be viewed. Section 2 of the Miner Act amended Section 316 of the Mine Act, the Federal Mine Safety and Health Act of 1977. That's an interim mandatory standard, a mandatory standard. That is the law of the land. So putting aside for the moment the question of conflict, what you have...
I'm not putting aside for the moment.
You can't put that aside.
Well, what you have...
I'm not putting it aside for a second. I'm wanting an answer to my question of what in the statute, in the regulation, conflicts with what's in the statute.
The key issue, the key principle that renders the rule fatally flawed, is that as of June 2006, we have a new governing standard, and that's called Section 2 of the Miner Act. That is the enforceable provision going forward. At no point in the six-month period between June 2006 and the promulgation of the EME rule in December 2006 did the Secretary address the Miner Act at all. Now, if she wants to put her improvement upon the Section 2 of the Miner Act.
What is it in the Miner Act that this regulation conflicts with?
The ability, well, specifically the ability to construct a common cache in the crosscut, i.e. the passageway between.
Is there anything in that statute that mentions the ability to construct a crash in a cross?
There is nothing. Well, let me answer that this way. There's nothing.
That's a yes or no. You answer it that way.
Nothing says that expressly, no. But nothing.
That's a no. But knock out all the rest. Take the thing off and the expressly, and it's a no. There's nothing in that act.
This court's cases make it clear that in interpreting a statute, you can look to the legislative history. And the legislative history, which both parties say.
Have you ever found a case in which we said that you get off at Chevron 1 and you win at Chevron 1 for an a clear mandate, violation of the clear language of Congress, and look to the legislative history for something that isn't in the statute?
Well, I cannot cite to you a case at
the
this point, Judge Sentel.
The reason you can't is there's not any, counsel. You can't win at Chevron 1 unless you can show something in the clear language of Congress. Legislative history is not law.
We absolutely win at Chevron Step 1, Your Honor, for this reason.
I'll go back to your, you know, legislative history.
Go ahead.
You're talking about the Senate report?
Correct. The conference report, yes.
Oh, the conference report. And when did that come out?
The conference report came out in December of 2006.
How many months after the passage of the statute?
Well, about 6.
About 6 months. Uh-huh. So we don't even have a situation in which the members of Congress who voted had even saw the conference report, right?
Well, I can't speak to that.
You know, I've had some experience in dealing with conference committee reports, and when I was in private practice and got to write part of them.
I understand.
Yeah, and this controversy was ongoing at the time that the conference report was being formulated, right?
Well, in that the rulemaking process was active, and the conference report hadn't yet been issued yet.
I think we can take judicial notice of the power of lobbying.
Yeah. We very seldom see a statute with this degree of specificity, and if your side in Congress had had the votes to get that in the act, they would have got that in the act. When you have the specifics that you have in this statute, you can't come in here, to use a Judge Edwards phrase, you can't come in here and argue that this is a Chevron 1 case and you win. If it's Chevron 1, you lose. Because there is nothing here in conflict with the language of the statute. I don't care what some friendly congressman got in the report 6 months after the statute. To win at Chevron 1, you have to show something in conflict with the statute. And it's not there, counsel.
Well, on the legislative history, I'll just note that both parties cite it, and no one has raised that it's not applicable in this case, so I would.
Both parties may cite it, but only one party needs it.
The operative portion of the Minor Act is that the approved plans shall, quote, afford minors a level of safety protection at least consistent with existing standards, including standards mandated by law and regulation.
That's right.
Okay. This ETS was a regulation in effect. It was an existing standard at the time this statute was passed, right?
That's right.
So how do you handle that?
Easily, Your Honor. In June 2006, with the passage of the Minor Act, which speaks to the exact same subject matter, at least in relevant part, that became the mandatory standard. It cut off. It superseded the ETS at that point. That became the law marching forward. That's how we went at Chevron Step 1, because the Secretary, absent an initiation of a new 101A rulemaking to put her improvement upon that standard.
You got a Minor Act that you're saying yourself has superseded the applicability of what Judge Randolph is saying, and it specifies caches of self-regulated rescuers provided in the aggregate area not less than 2 hours per minor to be kept in escapeways from the deepest work area to the surface at a distance of no further than an average miner can walk at 30 minutes.
That's correct.
Point out to me the part about these cross passages that's in that act. I just read you the relevant language.
Well, we've discussed it. You're not going to find it in the text of the statute. But what you're going
to one horse is dead, counsel, get off of it.
Well, let me move on to arbitrary and capricious, because the rule is certainly arbitrary and capricious. The Secretary failed to explain whatsoever why she rejected comments posed and submitted by industry that would have proposed a safe and feasible means of storing self-contained self-rescuers in a room that would be constructed in a crosscut between parallel escape ways.
Well, this approach is safer, right? Isn't it? The approach
by all means, this approach is safer.
The hardened room is safer than the alternative.
No doubt the hardened room is the safest thing. It's so safe, no one can afford it. So in the end, it actually implodes upon
it's
itself.
It's an alternative, as Judge Santel mentioned, to putting it in the escape
ways. Put it back in the escape ways like Congress.
It's an alternative.
Which is what the statute actually says.
It's an alternative in words. It's not an alternative in action. The Secretary herself didn't even analyze this for purposes of the Regulatory Flexibility Act.
The statute starts out with the proposition of having the equipment in the escape ways.
The ETS.
And these rules provide an alternative method of compliance. So that if you can't meet that alternative, you're left with the original. The worst that happens is you go back to the original.
Well, that's right. But what the secretary doesn't explain, and this is where it becomes arbitrary and capricious, is that there was a middle ground, a logical middle ground, something that is incrementally safer than storage in the escapeways alone, where the SCSRs are exposed in an emergency situation potentially to fire, explosion forces, falling roofs. Now you go to the hardened room. That's the alternative. Well, that's cost prohibitive, and it's not feasible for most, if not all, mines in this country. So what's an alternative? Well, how about the common cache that any number of industry people propose?
How about the one Congress enacted? I start out with Congress putting them in the escapeways themselves. When you come in and ask for a crosscut, they give you a crosscut, and you come back and say, well, the crosscut's not as good as it could have been, not as cheap as it could have been.
Again, if we're going back to the Miner Act, I suggest that it permits. It doesn't express.
Going back to the Miner Act, that's where we start from, isn't it?
It does not prohibit. I mean, this is a flexible. The whole emergency response plan system is supposed to. You're supposed to look at the unique physical characteristics at a given mine. That is what the Miner Act promotes. So hey, let's look.
When you do these things about what the Miner Act promotes, tell us what it says in the Act. What is it that it says in the Act that you say the Secretary is out of step with?
All the Miner Act says is you've got to have an additional 2 hours for each miner in the escapeways, and that each cache needs to be spaced at an increment of 30 minutes as the average miner walks out of the mine. Mm-hmm. Nothing prohibits the use of a common cache to accomplish.
Nothing permits it.
But nothing prohibits it.
The union were in here objecting that this is too cost beneficial to the mine owners, that this isn't safe enough. They might have a pretty good argument.
If the secretary wants to regulate by prohibiting common caches, she needs to initiate a rulemaking under 101A, and she never did that.
Why does she need to do that?
Because that's what Section 101A says.
Nothing about common caches, and she sits silent on the subject.
Because she's not.
Why does she need to initiate?
She's not enforcing the statute right now. She's enforcing the EME rule, and we have to look at these as two parallel systems. You can have the ETS that ultimately becomes the EME rule, or you could have a separate rulemaking that flows from the June 2006 Miner Act. Now, it may be at the end of the day she could get to where she is now. But she needs to do that, and she needs to let industry have its say through the notice and comment process. And quickly, I'd like to just move to the final issue, which is that of notice. Section 101A of the Mine Act is abundantly clear. It requires any rule to be proposed, the text in its entirety, in the Federal Register. The APA also says
general. Does that mean if there's any change, it has to be reproposed?
Judge Kavanaugh, I don't want to go so far and say that that's true, but at the very
and
least.
Doesn't your position lose its force?
No, because there's been no publication of a proposed rule of any kind.
But you're acknowledging that changes can be made for what's on your position on the statute. You're acknowledging that changes can be made from what's proposed to what's.
Conceptually, yes, changes can be made, but that's going to be decided. Whether that's a logical outgrowth will be decided on a case-by-case basis.
The emergency rule was the proposed rule, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Again, just to reiterate how we feel this case should be decided. Even if you assume, for sake of argument, that the hardened room rule, with all of its attendant requirements, flows from the ETS as a logical outgrowth, you don't get there because of the Miner Act, which became the governing law as of June 2006.
You think they needed a new proposed rule?
They needed absolutely, Judge Kavanaugh, absolutely. They're gaming the system. They're saying a consideration raised at a hearing is good enough to give notice. Well, it's not. Congress didn't say so. Congress didn't think so. Congress said you've got to propose a rule in the Federal Register and put its text in its entirety. Now, if there's going to be some tweaks down the road, this court's logical outgrowth doctrine permits that.
Do you not agree with you that they had to publish the new rule after the Miner Act? Then what's your position?
Can you repeat
that? If we do not agree that they had to publish a new rule after the enactment of the Miner Act, then what?
Well, then I don't assume arguendo that this is a logical outgrowth, and I tell you that if you look at the ETS as proposed, you don't see anything in there that gives the industry that tips the industry off to the fact that the secretary might at some point promulgate a rule that excludes all forms of common caches but for the hardened room, and then imposes on that hardened room the requirement that it be built to seal strength standards, that it provide an independent source of positive air from the surface, which both of those things render this largely infeasible for most mines in the country. And then it has to be proposed through the ventilation plan system.
It can be infeasible for most mines in the country and not be unlawful.
I'm sorry?
It can be infeasible for most mines in the country and not be unlawful. There's a non sequitur in your presentation.
But that's a separate issue.
It's infeasible for most mines.
Well,
it's
largely
irrelevant.
I would argue, Judge Sentell,
the statute speaking in terms of escapeways.
I would argue
the fact that you can't meet the alternative in most mines may be irrelevant.
I would argue, Judge Sentell, that whenever you have an infeasible rule, that's never a logical outgrowth. I mean, you don't go into a rulemaking. Certainly no agency that's acting reasonably goes into a rulemaking with the idea that, hey, you know what, the final outgrowth of this is going to be something that you guys can't comply with.
Why is it infeasible? Just because it costs a lot?
Yeah.
Well,
take a
western mine, a mine in Utah, for example. To put a borehole in from the surface, you're talking about maybe 2,000, 3,000 feet of overburden.
So that mine has to go back and put them in the escapeways, let Congress say.
Then you're left.
There's nothing in case law or statutory law that says that the provision of an alternative has to be available to all those who are covered by the original.
If you have to go back to the default rule, then we go back to arbitrary and capricious. Why not the common cache?
Is arbitrary and capricious to go with Congress?
I'm sorry?
That may be true, but I don't think we can write a precedent that says it's arbitrary and capricious to go with Congress. Congress provided a method.
Again, we don't get to the issue of what the Miner Act says isn't really before this court other than to recognize that it provides for.
Why no? It's Chevron 1.
It's Chevron,
not even before the court.
It's Chevron 1 to the extent that it is the law, and all this court should do is recognize that if the agency has something to say about Miner Act, it has to go through a 101A rulemaking. Otherwise, the Miner Act is not before this court for interpretation. It could be through an enforcement action, but that's not this case. It could be through a 101A rulemaking that we then challenge or UMWA challenges in a new petition, but that's not this case either. And I see that in the rebuttal time, and I don't want to give that up.
Thank you, Counsel. We'll hear from the respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Counsel.
May it please the court. My name is Jerry Feingold. I'm counsel for the Secretary of Labor, and with me at council table is Christian Schumann, also of the Solicitor's Office. Your Honors, I'd first like to address the notice issue, sort of do it in reversed order. We believe that the hardened room alternative for the placement of crosscuts in crosscuts of caches of SCSRs in hardened rooms is a logical outgrowth of the ETS. The proposed rule, which is the ETS, was immediately recognized by the industry as having a gap, they felt. They wanted to know from us, are we allowed to use common caches between two adjacent escapeways? And the first thing we told them was, no, you are not. But we kept the question in mind.
Can I ask you just a question about division of jurisdiction between labor and the Department of Interior over underground mines? What is that division there?
For all mine safety and health issues, it's before the Department of Labor. For reclamation and that type of thing, my understanding is it would be more.
That's Interior?
Pardon me?
That's Interior? Interior has jurisdiction over underground mines too, don't they?
Not in the mine safety and health area. They used to. Our act used to be administered by the Secretary of the Interior. And back when the Mine Act was enacted, they split and put the Mine Safety and Health before the Secretary of Labor.
Yeah, my memory was it was all Interior.
So. Many years ago.
Yeah, okay.
Now, when the Secretary first stated in these series of questions and the answers that you could not use common caches, the industry kept at us. They were not happy about this. So at four public hearings that the Secretary held, she brought up in an explicit manner the idea of possibly allowing them in the final rule to use common caches if they were placed in hardened rooms, and she read into the record at those public hearings what she meant by hardened rooms.
Was there a written questionnaire, or not, or a series of questions that captured that idea, too?
In the sense that the public hearings were transcribed and immediately put onto MSHA's website, yes, they were in writing. But she read them from a written statement, and they were exactly the same at each of the four public hearings. Now, at the Washington, D.C. public hearing on April 28th, Mr. Bruce Watzman of the NMA was sitting there and was the first speaker, in fact, right after the Secretary's representative had asked these series of questions. And Mr. Watzman stated that NMA would submit comments on the questions, but it never did. Now, as I said, the transcript of these were placed on MSHA's website.
But others did.
Others most certainly did submit comments, yes. And we got comments both in favor of allowing this and against allowing it.
What about the requirement that the proposed rules be published in their entirety?
That stems from the Mine Act in read in conjunction with the APA, Your Honor. And what that means is that in the Mine Act, it's not sufficient for a new rule proposal to simply state the idea of what the rule is about. It has to use verbatim language as an initial cut.
Does that requirement apply here?
Pardon me?
Why doesn't that requirement apply here?
We did use verbatim language of what we intended at the time it was enacted. This is a hybrid animal here that we're dealing with. It's not like a normal proposed rule, which would not have effect. This was both a proposed rule and an emergency temporary standard that went into effect immediately.
But 101B says that then you're supposed to kick back into the 101A procedures for the final rule.
Correct. But what I'm saying is that this court has recognized in the UMWA case that we cite in our brief that the rules of rulemaking that normally apply also under the Mine Act, such as notice and comment, and that the comments can then change the final rule, such as logical outgrowth.
That's the purpose of comments.
Pardon me?
That's the purpose of comments.
That's right.
Right.
That is exactly right. Now, after the public hearings, the Secretary placed a notice in the Federal Register, and that notice made reference to the questions that the Secretary had asked at the public hearings, and it extended the comment period for an additional 30 days. And as has been pointed out, MSHA received comments, both pro and con, for things that would be inconsistent and consistent with hardened rooms. We believe the record shows that NMA had both statutory and actual notice of what we intended to do. Again, their rep present said they were going to respond, never did.
Just so I have this clear, I think I do, but the proposed rule has to be published in its entirety. Then comments come in, changes are made. It doesn't have to be republished in its entirety, is your position?
No. The final rule gets published
right.
in its entirety.
Right. But it doesn't have to be reproposed.
That's exactly correct. Because
at least it's a logical
outcome. Exactly, Your Honor. Because if we did have to do with counsel and
so
and
this
their brief
section,
suggest,
what 101A means is it has to be the proposed rule has to be published in its entirety as opposed to the APA, which lets you throw out some issues.
Exactly correct. We can't just describe we intend to propose, we intend a final rule that might cover this and might
right.
cover that.
Granted, I'm borrowing from APA jurisprudence, but if it was no longer a logical outgrowth, then there might be an argument.
Exactly correct. Exactly correct. So, for instance, we could not come up with a subject area totally outside what that proposed rule was, but we can come up with a logical outgrowth. Now, because NMA had notice of what we were doing and what was at stake for them, it's newly developed evidence in this case, which has been submitted before this case, should be stricken, and we have filed a motion to strike. We believe that NMA also should have initially raised before the Secretary's rulemaking the issue of how the Miner Act affects the hardened room provision if they felt it did. I think Judge Sintel has pointed out pretty convincingly it doesn't, but if they felt it did and they wanted us to act in a certain way, they had at least 2 to 3 months that they could have mentioned this to us. They never sent any response to us. In addition, the final EME rule fully accords with both the Miner Act and the arbitrary and capricious standard. As an interim standard, The provisions of the Minor Act can be improved like any other interim standard by the Secretary. She may not promulgate any rule that in any way diminishes safety, but she can improve upon the rules that Congress has placed in as interim rules. And we believe the Secretary adequately explained the basis for her rule here. The preamble to the EME says that SCSR storage locations must be secured against damage from explosions in either escapeway. And we believe that this statement means that in an explosion, there can be a loss of redundancy that exists from having separate caches, one in each escapeway or in the crosscut right by each escapeway. The idea is if you're going to allow only one instead of the two, then we're going to be very, very sure that that one is going to survive in the case of an explosion. That's the quid pro quo.
I realize this is hitting you from the other direction, but you think allowing only the one is consistent with the statutory language that requires them to be in the escapeways?
We believe, since we believe that's an improvement, and council acknowledged that is the very safest.
You're allowed to improve on what Congress did?
Exactly correct. That's exactly what Section 101 of the Mine Act allows us to do. Now, the fact that the statute requires that these ERPs or ERPs, these plans, emergency plans, be approved on a case-by-case basis, and that we have said that these hardened room provisions will come in through ventilation plans and be approved by the district manager in no way conflicts with the expedited dispute resolution provision in the Minor Act. The plan is merely, the ventilation plan is merely a means by which the plan for the ERP is submitted to the Secretary. The Secretary is well aware of obligations for expedited considerations, and I think there should be a presumption of regularity that the government will do what the government is supposed to do and has said it will do. Of course, the operators have the option at any time if they feel we're not doing it, or they can tell the district manager, they can tell an administrative law judge, hey, this is supposed to be expedited. We also think that the Secretary adequately addressed the Regulatory Flexibility Act, the RFA. I would make two quick points. It makes perfect sense for the Secretary to be realistic and say that very few operators, relatively speaking, are going to choose this alternative, this option that they have of putting common caches in hardened rooms. The reason is because of the cost. There is no other reason. And so therefore, very, very few would be economically impacted under the Reg Flex Act. And to the extent that they do not complain about the cost involved with the primary compliance method, and the way I read their brief, they don't, then they're no harm anyway because they can simply use the regular compliance method of having them in each escapeway, and they're not complaining about the cost of doing that. And if there's no other questions, I would ask the court to affirm the rule.
Seeing none,
thank you very much.
How much time is left, rebuttal?
3 minutes remaining.
All right, counsel, we'll hear your rebuttal.
A quick point on the RFA. The Secretary acts from a faulty premise that the prejudice here is driven by economics. It's driven by safety to the miners. That is the number one goal of the Mine Act. The prejudice here, through not analyzing alternatives, the common caches, is that we're left with a rule that's not as safe. That's the prejudice. It's the prejudice of injury.
I don't understand that. I don't understand how your proposal is more safe than the hardened rule alternative.
No,
I understand what you're trying to do
with respect to the hardened room, I say, as counsel just acknowledged,
your proposal for the cross-cutting structure is not as safe as the hardened rule.
But as counsel for the Secretary just acknowledged, if it's too costly and no one's going to do it, therefore, in effect, it's no alternative
it can be
whatsoever.
In the escapeways, because Congress has specifically provided that it can be in the escapeways.
Well, and I'll note on the escapeways point that you know, the common cache is in the escapeways. It's right off in the crosscut that services both escapeways. There's nothing inconsistent about a common cache and the notion that SCSR
is... In the administrative record in this case, are there any diagrams of mines and showing crosscuts and what a hardened room looks like?
I believe as...
or diagrams, I don't photographs
think,
or anything?
I want to be careful. I am not familiar with any in the record. I know that there might be something that the Secretary has put out, but I can't
it's
point you to that.
There's a goalpost in there, but I didn't find it all that helpful.
Yeah.
Okay, well, you might think of the aisles, the parallel aisles in the seating section, and the crosscut would be any of the cut-throughs where the benches are.
How close are these, in general, the escapeways? How close are they to each other?
It's going to vary from mine to mine. You could be talking 20, 30, 40 feet. I mean, so what you have to come in, you know, it's not a significant difference.
When you say they're in the escapeways, they're not in the escapeways.
No,
they're in the escapeways.
But even the hardened room, if that's the approach, even the hardened room isn't in the escapeway. So we all agree that it satisfies the escapeway provision. Judge Kavanaugh, I want to point out you and
I'm sure about that, but anyway, go ahead.
Sometimes people say we wonder if they've got a twin we don't know about or something. When we say we all agree, I'm not sure.
Well, the hardened room is itself
agree, yeah.
A form of common cache, so it is also in the crosscut. Judge Kavanaugh, an important point. You had a colloquy with counsel about how she could improve upon the Minor Act, Section 2. Well, she can, but she needs to initiate a 101A rulemaking. We don't have a Minor Act rulemaking before the court. She didn't do that, and that's fundamental. The loss of redundancy, that's a post hoc argument. She never made that's not, you won't find that in the preamble to the final rule. That's something that you find in the brief.
What's your answer to the Labor's claim that if you had a problem with this rule being inconsistent with the Miners Act, you should have raised it?
Again, it comes back to the fundamental point that the only way that is ripe is if there had been a Minor Act rulemaking. We couldn't waive that because we had no occasion to weigh in on her interpretation of the Minor Act because there wasn't a 101A rulemaking under the Minor Act. She's trying to bootstrap her ETS by saying, oh, that was actually a Minor Act rulemaking
procedure.
You've
got a proposed rulemaking, or you've got a rulemaking going on, a statute's passed. And the proposed rule is flatly inconsistent with the new statute. And you have the comment period is wide open. You have no obligation to raise that. You just sit back and let the rule go into effect and then come into court and argue that it's inconsistent.
The comment period, this is an important point. The comment period that was open related to the ETS. That started 3 months before the Minor Act. That couldn't possibly have been a Minor Act comment process. The inconsistent.
Take the hypothetical as Judge Randolph posed it and answer that. If you have an open comment period and the statute passes and you're going to argue that the rule lacks consistency with the statute, can you just sit back, sandbag, and not raise that until the time you petition the court?
Well, for the reasons I said, I don't think it was right. But just on the merits of that question, mm-hmm. I would point you to the Pennsylvania Coal Association, page 269, I believe, of the Joint Appendix, where they say you need to go back and start over because the Minor Act supersedes the ETS.
Question. It's a different question.
Well, but that shows that...
It's a different question. Is the question open to be raised, or have you waived it by not bringing it up?
The answer to the question is we did not waive it because it was not an obligation we had. But on the merits, there were comments.
Better answer. Isn't the better answer is that somebody else raised it, so we didn't have to?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying we didn't have an obligation, but even if we did,
haven't answered the hypothetical. The hypothetical is whether there was an obligation to raise it at all. And your answer is somebody raised it.
But
that's, you're tampering with my hypothetical. Can you just answer the hypothetical?
No, there was no obligation.
No obligation.
Okay. Unless my colleagues have further questions, then your time is up and the case is submitted. Give us a recess.